This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of May 21st, here are a few top stories. In the news,
Arizona is known as a strong property rights state with low levels of regulation on home building. That's especially true in unincorporated areas of Maricopa County, like New River. But as KJZZ's Brett Jaspers reports, New River residents want stronger enforcement of the rules that do exist.
Ron Bentley has lived in New River since 1984. Back then, his was the only house on the hill.
Actually, when we first moved here, the deer would come and eat hay scraps along the fence line. I haven't seen a deer out here in 10 years.
Fewer deer, but more neighbors.
Now there's 23 homes up here on the hill. Well, as soon as they finish those four, there'll be 27.
Bentley is referring to four new homes built on one-acre lots just north of his home. These parcels have vexed Bentley and his neighbors for over a year. It started when they got wind a 10-acre chunk of land was on the market.
Then we started digging into who actually owned the property and found out that the two five-acre parcels were owned by two different LLCs.
LLCs or limited liability corporations. They can give business owners privacy and shield them from liability. Ron Bentley and his neighbors, and later KJZZ, found a web of LLCs related to the 10-acre parcel, often with common addresses and names. Property surveys for the two five-acre parcels had one common LLC listed as the owner. Meanwhile, property deeds listed other LLCs as the owners. Bentley suspected they were planning 10 houses on the 10 acres.
It was called working in concert to get around subdivision laws.
In unincorporated Maricopa County and much of Arizona, a subdivision is six lots or more. Land use lawyer Susan Demet says companies can make more money if they can avoid the demands of the subdivision process.
Infrastructure requirements, assured water supplies, I mean, all of those sort of standard things that come with a true subdivision. If you're able to avoid that, then you're able to, you know, get from A to Z much more quickly, efficiently, and less costly manner.
And New River residents are particularly sensitive to development. The community has had a water crisis since some wells have been drying up. Overdevelopment is exacerbating the problem, residents say. Mike DeMore at Morgan Taylor Homes, the developer, declined to comment for this story. Susan Demet and others note that Arizona has a long history of deferring to private property rights.
But it does present a huge opportunity for abuse of the system when you've got large tracts of land that over time just get divided and divided and divided, and you don't have a city water sewer system.
Bentley and his neighbors called the county when the developer started work without a permit. Construction paused, then restarted after they came into compliance. But that's a permitting issue. If a web of LLCs owns various deeds for a larger tract of land, the county can't stop them.
The counties only have the authority that the state grants to us.
Carol Johnson is director of Maricopa County Planning and Development.
We don't have any authority until after the fifth lot has already been created. So when it's six lots or more, that triggers a subdivision, and then our subdivision ordinance comes into play.
By state law, counties can elect to review plans for five or fewer lot splits, but they can't deny approval. Johnson says the county elected not to review splits because they couldn't do anything about it anyway. Ultimately, violations of the subdivision law are something the State Department of Real Estate investigates. Ron Bentley and his neighbors complained and then provided documents, surveys, and deeds. ADRE eventually launched an inquiry into the Morgan Taylor Homes development in New River. Louis DeTore of ADRE couldn't comment on the active case, but he said the department has recently renewed efforts to meet regularly with Maricopa County.
To have a discussion to say let's interact with each other and let's share information as we move forward and try to be proactive about that.
DeTore says citizen complaints are a big part of their investigation process. Ron Bentley says, hey, public officials should be doing this legwork.
If it's ADRE's rules to enforce, then I don't think the citizen should have to go to the extent of what we've gone through.
Work on a fifth house is paused as the county reviews a second permit violation. But again, that doesn't solve the subdivision question. Bentley's worried that without action on that, the four houses will turn into 10, one parcel at a time. Brett Jaspers, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From the Fronteras desk. When President Donald Trump called for a military presence at the border last month, state leaders rallied around the plan. National Guard units from across the country were deployed to the Mexican border, an executive mandate adopted by the last three U.S. presidents. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Tucson, Michel Morisco takes a closer look at how the operation plays out in southern Arizona.
Sorry. I'm going to be distracted trying to keep him from eating all your equipment.
Sergeant Thomas Ebbets of the Arizona Army National Guard pats the muzzle of a friendly Border Patrol horse with a taste for a reporter's microphone. Ebbets was deployed down to Nogales, Arizona last month as part of Operation Guardian Support. That's Arizona's contribution to Trump's call for the military on the border. 338 Arizona National Guard troops performing various jobs in support of the Border Patrol.
I'm over here. I take care of the herd for horse patrol. Take care of the feeding, watering, any medicines and stuff they need to. We have someone like Cobalt here who's on a special diet.
Unlike most of his colleagues, this isn't Ebbets' first time here. He was sent out during Operation Phalanx when President Barack Obama ordered the guard to the border facing concerns of unrestrained violence from Mexico. The National Guard deployment of Phalanx and an earlier operation involved running surveillance, criminal analysis, and observing and reporting illegal entries along the border. This time, the operation is purely a support role.
I deal with the agents daily, helping them tack up the horses and managing the herd. It really does relieve them. I mean, they're able to keep their teams in the field and be productive.
In his case, he freed up a Border Patrol agent who's now patrolling on horseback. Both the Border Patrol and the Guard wanted to demonstrate the support role, taking reporters to different parts of the agency's Nogales compound, including its garage.
Most common, tires. The off-road agents take it on the field every day. The tires get worn out pretty bad, so we have the capabilities of changing them and putting them back on.
National Guard Sergeant Leonardo Gastelum says those tires are the most common repair rolling into the Nogales Border Patrol Station garage. Today, he's working on the brakes of a gray federal pickup truck. And again, the message of a support role.
The mechanics here are great, but having extra hands, we get the vehicles faster to the field for those agents that need the vehicles guarding the border.
Border Patrol spokesman Daniel Hernandez says soldiers are only handling support for the agents.
And support mission only. So if we need a water truck brought somewhere, if we need a facilities repair at the checkpoint, that's the extent of it. No interaction with the public. We take that 100%.
But that hands-off support role is a little murky with guard troops in the air. The Border Patrol released this video Wednesday of a Missouri Guard helicopter helping to track down a group of people running from Border Patrol agents in the West Desert. The operation is intended to end September 30th, the close of the fiscal year. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Nogales, Arizona.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the KJZZ original production, The Show, here's Steve Goldstein and Mark Brody.
Arizona's music scene has produced several well-known singers like Linda Ronstadt and Stevie Nicks, Waylon Jennings and Dierks Bentley, Alice Cooper and CeCe Peniston.
Phoenix and Arizona have also played prominent roles in many songs, from By the Time I Get to Phoenix, performed by Glen Campbell, to By the Time I Get to Arizona by Public Enemy. Recently, KJZZ's Christina Estes picked up on a 50-year-old song many Phoenicians don't know about, and she learned about it, believe it or not, during a discussion of street names at a city council meeting. Christina, I have to ask, how exactly did this come about?
Well, the council was discussing how to handle a citizen's request to officially rename Broadway Road in South Phoenix to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. That's in Councilwoman Kate Gallego's district. While she's supportive of changing the name, she said a community-wide discussion would need to take place first. And it would need to include the local music crowd, which Gallego says is fiercely proud of a song called Funky Broadway. It was written and performed by R. Lester Christian, who went by the name Dyke. His band was called Dyke and the Blazers. Now, contrary to what some may think, Gallego says the song is not about Broadway in New York City. She says it's about Broadway Road in Phoenix.
Well, what are we waiting for? Let's hear some of it, Christina.
Okay, this is how it opens, and you have to listen closely to the words.
So Dyke is singing about every town having a street named Broadway. So what exactly is the Phoenix connection?
Well, there are a couple of connections. Dyke was originally from Buffalo, New York, where there is also a Broadway road. But in the 60s, he moved to Phoenix, where he wrote the song and his band recorded it. And here's where it got really interesting for me, a total novice when it comes to Phoenix music history. I listened to it a couple times and I thought, well, yes, this is clearly about Broadway Road in Phoenix. I grasped the song a little differently than John Dixon did. He's a founding member of the Arizona Music Hall of Fame and calls himself Arizona's unofficial music historian. We listened to the song and focused on some lines where Dyke sings about different cities. He mentions New York, Buffalo, L.A., and Phoenix. And you want to listen carefully to the Phoenix reference. That's where John and I discuss different interpretations.
Listen, I yield to your creativity and deep thought process.
But we have to explain that because listened to it, I heard all of these cities and areas and he said, they don't know,
yeah,
they don't know.
Yeah,
and then I heard him say Phoenix, but yes, they know.
Yes, they know. Hey, I'm learning. It's 2018 and I'm learning. I just remember the call outs of the city. And then we have to ask each other, Christine, what do we know that the other cities do not know? I mean, that's the million-dollar question. But
so let's
that's great. That's really neat. I'd never put that into the song.
And to be clear, for those of us who didn't know our sort of pre-discussion, I am not a music historian, had never heard this before. And when I listened to it, to me, I took away, oh, these other cities that have Broadway roads, oh, they don't know. This isn't about them. And then he says, Phoenix, yes, they know. And I was like, yay, it's about us.
You got me. But, you know, originally, too, and what kind of got us to this conversation was about the fact that in every city, as the song goes, every town I go in, there's a street. Name of the street is Funky Funky Broadway. So, and this is their first song, too, Christine. I mean, it's not like, you know, he's written 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 songs. This is the first song that that Dyke came up with. And so, you know, maybe in his mind, maybe Phoenix knew the Funky Broadway as maybe the dance. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's what they know that is special here that the other cities don't know yet. But that's very interesting that you would find that in the song this far on.
So how would you describe that music?
Funky, in a word, funky.
And let's go there because it was considered controversial, right?
Well, it was. I mean, as I say, that was a big deal. And some stations didn't play the record because of that, even when it came out on original sound. But, you know, times change and people hear more things and are exposed to more things. And then, of course, the word funky, the white kids started using. I mean, so much of the black verbiage and sayings and slangs and stuff pass over to the white side and the Spanish side, and people, it just becomes, you know, more common.
Was this really the first song that had funky in the title and the lyrics, or we
I
just
don't
think-
know. That's a good. We think it was, but certainly one of the first.
What did you bring with you?
Oh, I brought a CD, probably the best if you are into Dyke. It's Dyke and the Blazers, We Got More Soul, that Ace Records in England put out a few years ago.
Why?
Well, as in all things musical, it seems like the Brits and other countries appreciate our music sometimes more than we do. A lot of the British companies were reissue companies, and so they would take these very obscure soul and funk 45s and bring them into the digital age and put them out on CDs. Sometimes it's like a 12-song greatest hits. In this case, they went all the way back to the vaults. They found unreleased tracks. They remixed a couple of tracks. So this is really a very, very complete set musically, and the liner notes are just very, very in-depth about Dyke's history and the band and the songs.
What happened to Dyke? Because my understanding is he was shot to death.
Yes.
When he was like 27,
28? Yeah, young, yeah, yeah. I mean, he was, it was a very young death and, you know, and very sad. I mean, you would think he was still a man of the streets. I mean, some people change and enjoy and the finer things in life. He always, you know, was a street. He came from the streets and he died on the streets. He didn't. Many people take advantage of the income and, you know, move to the north side of Thomas Road, shall we say, McDowell. But Dyke felt more comfortable on the streets of Phoenix, the gritty streets of Phoenix at the time.
On Funky Broadway.
Yes.
In education news, it's trendy nowadays to shrink down and play with our ideas of structure. Microloans and tiny homes, for example. What could be next? Micro schools. As KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports from our education desk, one specialized Phoenix high school just finished its first year ever with less than 50 students, and more to come.
The Gifted and Talented Academy takes up all of two classrooms at Maryvale High School. It's kind of like a Russian nesting doll of education, a tiny school within a school of 3,000 people. Science teacher Renu Singh created the program.
Because if you'll compare with the 3,000 students on this campus, we have only 42, which is a microcosm.
A microcosm of students specially chosen for their gifted abilities and needs. The idea is to keep those students in their core classes, like geometry or history, within the academy through their senior year. Then they take electives like language and music classes with other Maryvale students. Singh says she visited other specialized schools and found that sectioning off a particular group of students doesn't always address needs for growth as a person rather than in academics.
What we are trying to do is a holistic, bringing holistic education to these students so that they can unfold in their own unique way.
Singh gathers with one of her teachers and the principal in a small room on the last Friday of instruction, right next to one of her classrooms. Maryvale principal Manuel Silva says when he first heard about the idea, he was a little skeptical.
When I first found out, I was, I don't want to say fear, but it was the unknown.
It was an unprecedented idea of the micro school within the huge Maryvale campus. But Silva says it addresses a need in the West Side by targeting students looking for challenging coursework in public district schools without having to leave their neighborhood.
You do see a lot of other, you know, charter schools, and our students want to stay within Phoenix Union, and this is to give them an opportunity to attend courses that are at higher levels but have a full access to a large comprehensive high school feel.
The Gifted and Talented Academy focuses on challenging coursework in freshman and sophomore years. then transitions to career and college goals by junior and senior years. Academy Social Studies teacher Annie Shanahan says freshmen are given accelerated coursework in civics and science, and the small class sizes of around 20 give each student a personalized lesson plan.
Every student in the Gifted and Talented Academy passed their civics exam, which they need to graduate high school, so that every single student has accomplished that task as a freshman rather than waiting until they're a senior.
Walking across campus to the other classroom, students take selfies in the hall as the school year wraps up. The micro school's first class of freshman students finished geometry and economics courses on their laptops just before lunch. Freshman Abel Salas says he likes the challenging stuff, but that it's not just more homework.
We had to do a passion project, and that was a project where we had to do what we liked. Like, we did a presentation on what we loved in life and all that.
And his passion is one any high schooler would find interesting.
It was memes, because I really like funny pictures and all that.
Salas is thinking of going into law or biochemistry and is exploring his options through the academy program. He went to Cartwright Elementary nearby and was looking at several high schools, some farther away, but ultimately chose this micro school.
So it was either the Gifted and Talented Academy or Metro Tech High School. I'm glad it's so close to my area.
Lunch starts and half the students come back to eat in the academy classroom, while some noodle on the guitar in the corner. These inaugural students will come back to Maryvale next year and the next to be joined by what Singh hopes will be a school size of about 200 for the Gifted and Talented Academy. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You're listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Business Desk, here's the show's Lauren Gilger.
The future of Uber's self-driving car technology is once again in question. The National Transportation Safety Board just released its preliminary report on the self-driving Uber vehicle that struck and killed a woman in Tempe in March. And yesterday, the company announced it is shutting down self-driving car operations in Arizona. This after the company got such a warm welcome in our state just a few years ago. For more on all of this, I'm joined by Andrew Hawkins via Skype. He covers transportation for The Verge. Andrew, first, can you tell us what's in the NTSB's initial report here?
Yeah, it's pretty short, but what it does is sort of, it provides a pretty detailed account of what happened the night of March 18th in Tempe, Arizona, when an Uber vehicle that was a self-driving car struck and killed a 49-year-old pedestrian. So it sort of describes in detail the technology that Uber uses to power its vehicles. It sort of sets up what happens in the immediate minutes right before the crash and explains what all the parties are saying is the explanation for what happened. But it doesn't draw any conclusions. It doesn't assign any blame or provide any analysis. That's to come in another report, the final report, which won't be out, is my understanding, until at least early next year.
Okay. So let's talk about how Uber is shutting down its self-driving car tests here in Arizona. This was announced yesterday, the same day that Tempe police issued a statement saying that they had completed their report on the collision. So do you think those two things are related?
Of course, they're absolutely related. So Uber said that they were shutting down their system, their testing program in Arizona. It was pretty significant because Uber had come to Arizona initially because California had denied its permit to test its vehicles in that state. Mm-hmm. So Uber made a very big show of bringing all its cars to Arizona, where the regulatory system was a lot more favoring of the company. There's not as many rules as there was in California. That said, flash forward, a year, and now we have, this sort of tragic crash that took place, and Uber is now fully pulled out of the state. Of course, leading up to that, the governor of Arizona, Doug Ducey, had rescinded Uber's permission to test its vehicles. Mm-hmm. So he kind of broke up with them before they were able to break up with Arizona.
Right, right. But what kind of broader effect might this have on the self-driving car industry? Like, is this a major setback for Uber and its efforts?
Most certainly is it a setback for Uber, and it has been since the crash first happened. The company immediately halted all of its testing across North America back in March, and now it won't be operating at all in Arizona. It's laid off all of its workers there, a majority of whom are the safety drivers that ride along in the vehicles while the vehicles are driving autonomously. So around 300 people are being laid off. Mm-hmm. And it seems like what's going to result now is that Uber is going to have a very much more scaled back, a slimmer version of its testing program when it eventually starts it back up again. I spoke to the CEO of Uber just recently, Dara Khosrowshahi, and he talked about getting back on the road by as early as this summer. Even while they are sort of making plans for a much slimmer program, it does seem that they are still anticipating getting back on the road pretty soon.
Okay. How much does this help out their competitors like Waymo, which is also here in Arizona?
Yeah, so that, I think that Waymo has always sort of been out front of all of the other companies that are operating self-driving cars. Google, which is the company that Waymo was spun out of a couple of years ago, has sort of been at the forefront of this whole industry for a long time. They have been testing these types of vehicles since the mid-2000s, around 2008, 2009. And they've have more miles and more data than pretty much any other company aside from Tesla. And they're preparing to start a commercial robot taxi service later this year in Arizona. So while Uber is sort of dealing with the fallout from this very tragic event, Waymo is moving ahead briskly and is already planning on how it wants to make money from this whole thing.
Right, right. I know we've talked about this in the past, about how the public's trust in this technology has a lot to do with how successful it will be. So does an accident like what happened with Uber even affect its competitors, affect the industry in general, because people are just not sure they want to get in a self-driving car?
Yeah, it most certainly does. And I think there was a survey that came out recently by AAA that showed a pretty sharp increase in fear and skepticism amongst people about self-driving cars. Mm. So you have 3/4 of respondents saying they wouldn't ride in a driverless vehicle. That's a pretty big number of people. And you know, if these companies, Waymo, Uber, Ford, GM, and all the others that are working on this technology ever want to see a return on their investment, it will rely almost entirely on public acceptance. And right now that public acceptance is pretty low. Now that said, I think a lot of it has to do with a lack of experience with this technology. Most people are forming these opinions based on what they read in the media, based on stories and news reports. And they don't have personal experience with these cars. So maybe I think the operators need to have low expectations in terms of sort of the initial stage. There will be sort of, you know, those people who are, you know, want to be sort of first adopters and are intrigued by sort of the futurism and the newness of this all. And it'll really be incumbent on those folks to tell their stories before we start to see a wider adoption of this technology.
Yeah. All right. That's Andrew Hawkins. He is a transportation reporter for The Verge. Andrew, thank you so much for the time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And finally, from the Science Desk, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody and Mariana Dale.
Arizona's bald eagle population has continued to grow since the birds were removed from the endangered species list in 2007. One reason why is because every year a dedicated group of biologists camp out and watch the next generation from egg to first flight. From KJZZ's East Valley Bureau, Mariana Dale reports.
Leah Bader's office is a hill overlooking a stretch of the Verde River.
Okay, I set my alarm for 4, and I was making my coffee by about 20 to 5.
This brisk morning, she's bundled up in layers. Short pink hair pokes out from beneath a beige knit hat, and silver eagle earrings hang from her ears. She points her telescope at the nest tree, hundreds of yards away.
I just say it's the biggest, tallest, fluffiest cottonwood out there.
Bader waits for an adult eagle to drop off prey, a sure sign there's a chick in the nest.
Well, I say they don't feed eggs.
Bader's one of about 24 people Arizona Game and Fish hires every year to keep a close eye on the bald eagle nests. They're on watch almost every day between February and June. Most are field biologists chasing seasonal work. Bader is an exception.
I'm chatty liberal arts major, and I've become an intense observer and understander of maps.
She's a veteran watcher. This is her 10th year traveling from Wyoming to Arizona for the season.
The nest watchers that we have out there, they really serve as our front lines.
Tuck Jacobson is the Raptor Management Coordinator for the Arizona Game and Fish Department. He says Arizona's bald eagles are uniquely adapted to the harsh desert, and most don't leave the state.
If population in Arizona declines, it doesn't have other populations that are going to help bolster it.
When the Nest Watch program started in 1978, Arizona's eagles and those around the country had been decimated by the pesticide DDT and humans. Now there are more bald eagles than ever recorded in Arizona. Jacobson says it's in part because nest watchers keep people, paragliders, and these days, drones, away from sensitive nest sites.
The observers are able to see that bigger picture and identify what's actually causing those issues.
Arizona's program is thought to be the only one of its kind. For one, because the population here is small compared to other states. Arizona has about 67 active nests this year. Minnesota, for example, has over 2,300 eagle breeding pairs. On this day, we're just feet away from another nest, so game and fish biologists can mark and measure the young chicks. The parent eagles circle overhead. Vader drops her voice to a whisper.
I was super nervous the first time I held one. I had to be talked into it.
She nestled the brown-gray bird under her arm, its already sharp talons wrapped in cloth. Sometimes Vader can't help but talk about the birds like they're humans.
Eagles are the strong, sensitive type. They're a mighty bird, but little things can harm them.
A few weeks after that visit, one of the two chicks in the nest dies. Vader thinks an evening windstorm swept the little female from the tree.
You know, that was really sad. It was one of those bad days.
These small tragedies are part of eagle watching. Vader says it's helped her process her own brother's death. He passed last year, just before the nesting season.
The coming and going and the life and the death that you see in plants and animals and everything out here is, I don't know, it just helps me to know my place.
What do you think your place is?
Temporary.
Not long after the first eagle chick died, the other one disappeared from the nest. Vader scoured the ground underneath the tree.
Walking back and forth, and underneath vegetation, underneath, I just hear a little rustling. And something scooted off there. I'm like, baby!
A success. The young bird was alive, and it's back home for now. Vader will continue to watch from a distance until the little eagle flies from the nest on its own. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, reporting from the Fort McDowell Yavapai Nation.
And Mariana Dale joins us now in studio. So, Mariana, any updates on those little eagles?
I do have some. So I was talking with Leah this morning, and the last chick that was mentioned in the story, that little male that had fallen from the desk, he has successfully flown on his own now. So
all
that
right.
means the Fort McDowell nest yielded two eagle fledglings this year.
And what's the likelihood that eagle will one day be raising its own chicks?
Well, that's kind of the downer about some of this work sometimes. And even if they do survive their first flight like this one did, biologists estimate 3/4 of them will die before they reach adulthood. And so that's why it's so critical that Arizona gives every single eagle the best chance.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the area where you were reporting the story?
So eagle nests are spread throughout the state. They're mostly in central Arizona, and then there's a couple up north near Flagstaff. And several of the nest sites are on the Fort McDowell Yavapai Nation, which is east of Phoenix by Fountain Hills. The bald eagle's protection there is a collaboration between the tribe and biologists. Throughout the nesting season, Vader and her partner, her eagle-watching partner, Jen, they visit the school children. They go to Earth Day celebrations, senior centers, and all of that to share what they've learned about the tribe's bald eagle community.
Now, the eagle is obviously a national symbol, but is there any special significance for the Yavapai people?
Yeah, bald eagles play a role in their history and in their culture. So in a couple of versions of the Yavapai creation story, there is a young boy who disguises himself as prey in order to get carried up to an eagle's nest. And once there, he kills the family of eagles that had in turn murdered his mother. So the eagle is actually kind of the bad guy in their creation story. But as former President Raphael Baer explains, the eagles kind of have a redemption story.
Some people even believe now that it actually repaid us by actually coming out and, I don't know how you would say it, but saving us from the threat of the Orem Dam.
And what was the Orem Dam?
So the Orm Dam, the federal government, they tried to build this dam that would have flooded most of the tribe's land in the 1970s. And like any big environmental project, there was a ton of controversy. The Yavapai fought the Orm Dam proposal, and they actually won. That's why the nation's still there today. Some of their allies in this fight were conservationists because the land that would have been flooded included eagle nesting sites. Donald Beckman grew up on the Fort McDowell Yavapai Nation and said he was taught that the ancestors kind of pointed to the eagles for answers.
It's just like the ancestor says, they will come when you need help. They know.
Beckman also participates in some Yavapai songs and ceremonies, and when he sees an eagle in the wild, he'll actually reach out to it in song.
You just sing to him like you're happy. I'm happy that you're here, or it's good that I see you. I could almost understand you, what you're saying in your words.
All right, that's been KJZZ's Mariana Dale. Mariana, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.